it's Caitlin from C-SPAN. Did you know that C-SPAN has been serving the American people for 45 years? Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners. And now, with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45. Your contribution helps to ensure that we can continue to provide unfiltered, complete coverage of government proceedings on TV, online, on radio, and our mobile app, as well as context through newsletters, social media, and podcasts. Join us in preserving this legacy of access to the democratic process. Make your tax-deductible donation today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
Rob Henderson, author of Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class. You write that the late Yale historian Harold Bloom once told you that you were forged in a fire. What'd you mean by that?
Well, that was shortly after I arrived at Yale. Harold Bloom, it was an esteemed literary critic and professor at Yale, and he was in his sort of twilight years at that point, and I visited him at his home when I was a student at Yale, and I conveyed my, you know, the shortened, abbreviated version of my story to him, and he was 87 years old at this time, and he listened quietly, and at the end, he gently said, you were forged in a fire, and I think he, that was his maybe poetic way of responding and encapsulating the experiences that I'd had growing up in foster homes in Los Angeles, enlisting in the military when I was 17, all of the setbacks and hiccups and all of the family drama and turmoil that I'd experienced all throughout my childhood, born into poverty and attempting to make my way in the world.
You also had a Yale friend tell you that you hit the adoption lottery. Do you agree with that?
Well, he was mostly commenting on my adoptive family and how they had won this kind of adoption lottery. You know, when you're an adoptive parent and you receive a kid who has maybe had many difficult experiences in foster care, as I did, to some extent, you are taking a bit of a risk, a bit of a chance. You're not entirely sure how things will go. I mean, this is true for any child, regardless of circumstances, but you know, perhaps especially so for kids in foster care. And so this friend of mine at Yale made this joke about, oh, your family won the adoption lottery. And I think he meant that, you know, my family, who, you know, they were kind of working class, they weren't college educated, kind of blue collar background. And, you know, they adopt this kid out of the Los Angeles foster care system. And, you know, despite a lot of difficulties and self-defeating behaviors and all of the other things I had experienced that I note throughout my book, I ended up ultimately having a, you know, relatively successful enlistment in the Air Force and somehow managed to get into Yale and then went on to obtain a PhD at the University of Cambridge in England and have managed to make, you know, something of my life. And I think my adoptive family is at least as surprised as I am that things have turned out this way.
How many homes had you lived in by the age of eight?
By the age of eight, well, if we count, so all of the foster homes until the age of eight, I lived in seven different homes in the foster system in Los Angeles. My adoptive mother later gave me this file full of documents from foster, you know, people involved in my situation in foster care, social workers responsible for my case, forensic psychologists and doctors and teachers and so on. So it was a very thick file. And, you know, reading through it, you know, I discovered, you know, before I was able to form memories when I was just a baby, an infant, my birth mother and I were homeless for a time. We lived in a car, and then eventually we settled in this slum apartment in a poor area in Los Angeles. And then from there, I was placed into the system. So, you know, 7 to 10 homes, depending on how you count, by my 8th birthday.
In your book, Troubled, you write about your earliest memories. If you ask most people to recall their earliest memory, it's usually from when they were around age 3. Here is mine. It's completely dark. I am gripping my mother's lap, burying my face so deeply into her stomach I can't breathe. I come up for air and see 2 police officers looming over us. I know they want to take my mom away, but I'm scared and don't want to let her go. I fasten myself in her as hard as I can. My internal alarms are going off and I'm sobbing. I want the strange men in black clothes to leave. The memory picks up, like a dream, in a long white hallway with my mother. I'm sitting on a bench next to her drinking chocolate milk. My 3-year-old legs dangle above the floor. I sneeze and spill my chocolate milk. I look to my mom for help, but she can't move her arms. She's wearing handcuffs. What else do you remember about your birth mother?
So those are the sum total of my memories of my birth mother, sort of firsthand memories. I have, you know, I mentioned that filed these documents before, and there were some other facts I learned about her. She was from Seoul, from South Korea. She came to the U.S., to California, as a young woman to study. And, you know, after some years, she became severely addicted to drugs. I learned that she has 2 other sons besides me. So I have 2 older half-brothers who I've never met. They have 2 different fathers. So she's had at least 3 children, 3 sons with 3 different men. I've never met them. And I've never seen my mother since those events when I was 3, when she was arrested and subsequently deported back to Korea. I was born in Los Angeles, so I was a U.S. citizen, and I was placed into the system. And, you know, she was asked by forensic psychologists and, you know, law enforcement. They asked her if she knew who my father was, to see if maybe I could be placed with him. And she replied that she didn't know who he was. She said that she, you know, had some inkling that his name was Robert, and that's why I was named after him. But otherwise, she doesn't know anything else about this man or where he went or what he does. I didn't learn anything about my birth father until later. I actually recently took a 23andMe genetic ancestry test a few months ago. And, you know, I went the first, you know, 30 some years of my life knowing nothing about him, and, you know, learned that he was Hispanic. He was Mexican. So the 23andMe results indicated that my father had, could trace his lineage to Spain and to sort of indigenous parts of Mexico, North America. And, I didn't know that part of my ethnic background. So I'm, you know, half Asian, half Hispanic. And as far as my mother, I haven't seen her since those events. And, you know, I think about those flashbulb memories on occasion that I have with her. You know, when I was a kid and I saw those men in the black clothes, I didn't know that they were police officers. At age 3, I wasn't sophisticated enough to understand what was really happening there. But, I knew that they held, you know, just instinctively, that they held some kind of authority, some ability to separate us. And this was, a terrifying experience for me as a kid. And I didn't really understand what was about to happen, what was about to unfold, that, you know, that would be, you know, essentially the last time I'd ever see her.
Have you done any further research to find out who your father's family is?
No, I haven't. I haven't dug into that. I suppose, you know, I could hire a private investigator or someone to explore my father's side of the family. But, you know, I've been asked about this, about, you know, have I ever thought about reconnecting with my mother or seeking information or contact with my father? And I've never really had a strong desire to do so. My feeling is essentially that, you know, they didn't prioritize my, my needs, they didn't prioritize my upbringing and security and safety and all of those things. And so I just feel, you know, I don't really see the need to devote resources and time to seek these people who clearly did not have my best interest in mind. So yeah, that's kind of where I sit with it. I've spoken with other people who've been adopted, and some of them have been in different circumstances where their parents did have some residual care for them and they could see that. But in my situation, I don't really feel that way. And I've never really felt a strong urge to reconnect.
Back to your book, Troubled. When I was a baby, my mother and I lived in a car. About a year later, we moved into a slum apartment in Westlake, a poor neighborhood in LA. Documents from social workers report that my mother would tie me to a chair with the bathroom belt so that she could get high in another room without being interrupted. She left bruises and marks on my face. While my mother did drugs, I would cry from the other room as I struggled to break free. Rob Henderson, when you think about this, what kind of rights should birth mothers and fathers have?
Well, I think the current system is set up to prioritize the rights of birth parents, and you know, I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I think in most cases it's probably the right call. In most cases, birth parents do care deeply for their children, but there are extraordinary circumstances. Mine was one of them, where my mother was, my father was just completely absent, not in the picture at all, and you know, possibly didn't even want to be. And my birth mother was severely addicted. She would have people coming in and out of the apartment at all hours of the day and night, trading favors for drugs. And, you know, in most cases, I was a nuisance to her. She, you know, was extremely neglectful, did enough to keep me alive, but not much more beyond that. And so in this case, ultimately, you know, the state of California, they made the right call in putting me in foster care. But, you know, these are two horrible options. Foster care is far from an ideal arrangement for young children, developing children, and being with a, you know, neglectful drug addicted mother is also far from optimal as well. And so, you know, you have two very bad decisions and you just have to choose the one that's less bad.
Rosalina Burton testified before Congress about her childhood in foster care in 2015. Here's a short portion of her testimony.
I spent most of my childhood in San Diego County foster care system. I was in and out of foster care, experiencing 12 years in care and more than 23 different placements. I eventually aged out of congregate care, and I'm still hoping to find my forever family. My six siblings and I had been removed from my parents' care for the first time after my mother went away to receive treatment for addiction, and my father was reported for neglect. My siblings and I were taken to an emergency shelter. Then one of my sisters and I were soon placed with my paternal great aunt. My great aunt was a prepared woman, and living with her gave me a sense of stability, love, and normalcy that I unfortunately never experienced again. While living in my great aunt, I saw my siblings and parents regularly. I felt close to them and desired their presence in my life. Later, after we were scattered throughout foster care and group homes, my close-knit sibling group became strangers to each other. By the time I was 13, I often worried that if one of my siblings were to pass, I would not have anything to say at their funeral because I didn't even know who they were anymore.
Rob Henderson, throughout her testimony, I saw you nodding your head.
Well, when she mentioned the stability with her great aunt, that's something that every child craves, to have a secure, stable attachment to a parent or a caregiver or some adult who they trust and who has their best interests in mind. And, you know, that was something that I lacked in all of the foster homes that I had lived in. I mean, she'd mentioned living in, 20 some placements in by age 13, 12, which is, I mean, that's just extraordinary that children have to experience that. I mean, I lived in seven homes in about, you know, just shy of 5 years. And, you know, there's this question of why does the system work this way? Why are kids so frequently placed into different homes? And one reason is because often what happens with foster children is that a birth relative will re-enter the picture Maybe the mother sobers up, or the father returns, or in this case, her great aunt was able to care for her. But if a child is in one placement for too long, this can create issues of attachment and loyalty. So if a foster child is with one family, a foster family, for 6 months or a year, and they become comfortable and devoted to this family, and then suddenly a family member returns, often the child doesn't want to leave. And so also on the part of the foster parent, they become attached to the child and become reluctant to relinquish the child when a birth relative returns. And so the system has, sort of resolved this by frequently placing a child in different environments such that there's never any potential issues with loyalty or devotion or conflict between foster families and birth relatives. And I think it, maybe it sounds nice in the abstract, but often this just introduces a lot of instability and a lot of difficulty in children's lives because, this is a robust finding, confirmed finding in developmental psychology research that children, especially from the ages of about from birth to about 5 to 7 years old, those first few years of life are critical for forming secure attachments and, forming an internal sense of self and trust and bonds and the ability to, form healthy relationships with other people. And, it's no wonder when you look at the statistics and the outcomes for kids who live in foster care, they're just abysmal. Very few kids end up having, any kind of healthy, flourishing, kind of successful life when they go through a system like that. And yeah, it's, there's this statistic that I cite in the book that for college graduation rates, in the U.S. overall, it's about 35% of U.S. adults obtain a bachelor's degree. And for children who live in poor families and families in the bottom income quintile, 11% of children from those families go on to graduate from college. But for foster kids, it's only 3%. Some statistics actually suggest it's less than 3%. But if we call it 3%, what this means is that a child born to a poor family in the United States is 4 times more likely to graduate from college than a kid who has spent time in foster care. And that's how tall the obstacles are, how long the odds are against a kid in the system.
Back to your book, 1 in 5 foster kids are placed in 5 or more homes throughout their time in the system. 3/4 of foster kids spend at least 2 years in foster care. 33% stay 5 or more years. 1 in 4 are adopted. The median age for leaving foster care is 7 years old. And according to the Department of Health and Human Services, there are about 391,000 children in foster care in fiscal year 2021. Asians, about 2,000. Black or African American, about 87,000. Hispanic, 85,000. Native Americans, 9,400. White, 168,000. And some of the reasons for children being removed from their birth homes include neglect, parent drug abuse, caretaker inability to cope, physical abuse, housing, and parent incarceration. Are foster families, are they looked at carefully before they're allowed to take in children?
Well, you'd mentioned, somewhere in the ballpark of 400,000 kids in care. And what shocked me as I was doing some research for this book is that this number, it was a report from NPR that found that the number has roughly doubled since the year 2000. And this is largely due to some of the reasons you had just outlined there. But the big one was drug abuse, drug addiction, in the wake of the opioid crisis and easier access to hard drugs, prescription drugs, street drugs. It's just easier than ever now compared to 20 plus years ago to obtain those. And this is having a detrimental effect on parents' ability to supply care for their kids. It's these reasons, all of these facts, these contribute to the deterioration of families in general. But for kids, you'd mentioned the the sort of ethnicity, the demographic breakdown of these families, the way that I remember it, it was more or less, I mean, it matched that. California was unique. I mean, I was in Los Angeles, so, you know, I think most of my foster siblings were Hispanic. We had some of my foster siblings were Black. We had some white kids. There was only one other Asian kid in one of the homes. But yeah, that was, you know, roughly mirrored what you would expect for that part of California. It's a terrible system. I mean, when you consider just how unstable it is and the effects of instability on young children, I make this, you know, I report some interesting data that I uncovered as I was, you know, researching and reviewing all of the sort of research in psychology for outcomes for children in these impoverished and dysfunctional circumstances. And one thing that shocked me was, this has been consistently discovered. So researchers will make a distinction between childhood harshness and childhood instability. And harshness is essentially low family income, sort of meager financial resources, growing up poor. And instability is, this is captured by a variety of different questions in these surveys asking people how frequently they relocated when they were children, how many different parents or caregivers they lived with, if their parents were married or divorced, if they had a single parent, how many different romantic partners their parent had. And it was so it basically captures sort of day-to-day unpredictability and instability. And what the research consistently shows is that childhood harshness or childhood poverty has kind of a tenuous link with detrimental outcomes in adulthood, things like incarceration or substance abuse or poverty or teen pregnancy rates. The correlation is small. Some find no statistical relationship whatsoever between poverty and those outcomes, but there is a clear and strong relationship between instability and those outcomes later in life. Other researchers have actually looked at, they've compared children raised in wealthy but unstable families. So if there's divorce or addiction or abuse or just a lot of sort of turmoil and drama within a wealthy family, if a child grows up in that those kinds of circumstances, despite having all of their material needs met, those children have worse outcomes in life compared to children born in poor families that are sort of married and stable and secure and prioritize the well-being of the child. And that was one of the more stunning findings, but it later it matched actually a lot of what I saw as I transitioned to the military and to college and so on, just sort of observing people from different sorts of family environments.
Rob Henderson, who was Mrs. Martinez?
She was Mrs. Martinez, she was the final foster parent that I had. This was something that I'd, only in hindsight, you know, as an adult sort of reflecting on these homes, I realized kind of unsurprising that in every home I had, the primary caregiver was, you know, was a woman. Often the foster fathers were at work or they were kind of checked out. They weren't really involved in the caretaking circumstances. And so you'd mentioned, I mean, how much do you know, foster parents, how carefully are they evaluated or assessed? My sense is that not very much, simply because the system is so overburdened. I just recently read that Los Angeles has one of the most overburdened systems, meaning they have a surplus of children who need homes and there aren't enough foster parents to take them in. And of course, you know, the state isn't going to allow children to sleep on the streets. And so, you know, in response, they lower the threshold for who can qualify to be a foster parent. And essentially, my sense is that short of outright abuse, social workers and the system will kind of look the other way. If it's kind of basic neglect or, you know, less than adequate caregiving, that they will, you know, allow a child to, you know, it's better for them to sleep in a neglectful environment than to be, you know, out in the cold. Mrs. Martinez, that home that I lived in was unique for a lot of reasons, but one of them was because I was the only kid in that home. So her husband worked, he was seldom home. She was more or less a, you know, stay-at-home homemaker. And I remember when I first arrived in this home, I was 7 years old, and I, you know, was like first just stunned how clean this house was, because all of the foster homes I lived in, all six of them beforehand, were I mean, it was just, you know, in various states of squalor. Some of these homes that I lived in had 8 or 10 plus kids living in them. You know, it was just some of these, the houses I lived in, it would be, you know, or a duplex or an apartment, it would be in a one bedroom with two bunk beds. So it'd be four kids to a room. So two kids on the top bunks, two kids on the bottom bunks. And, you know, when you have that environment with so many kids, it's impossible to keep them clean. I arrive at Mrs. Martinez's house and notice how clean it is. And then gradually I came to realize that she would take in young foster boys, typically, you know, kind of before puberty, but kind of old enough to follow instructions. So I was 7 at this point. And she was very stern and very kind of this austere, cold woman, where, you know, they had this small pool in the back. I would clean it. I would sweep and mop the floors on a daily basis, rake the leaves, cut the grass. She had two dogs that I fed and walked and took care of. She later got a parrot, Mr. Carlos, which I describe in the book. To this day, I have, my attitude towards birds is, you know, pretty negative. I don't like birds in general, and especially not parrots. And probably because of those experiences feeding this bird that was, you know, it had sharp claws, a sharp beak, and I would have to get very close to feed it. And sometimes it would poke me or stab me or scratch me. And whenever I, you know, would ask her, why do I have to do these chores? I'd go to school and then I'd come home and work for 4 or 5 hours around the house. And she would say, it's because, you know, I'm trying to keep you out of trouble. There's a lot of bad kids in this neighborhood. And, you know, I don't want you getting into any mischief with them. And she was right to some extent. There were kids in this neighborhood. And I did find ways to get into trouble with them and get into mischief and learn to steal and pickpocket and vandalize buildings and, you know, steal and so on. But I think a lot of that was also just self-serving reasoning, that she really liked keeping a spotless and clean home. And she didn't really seem to mind if I wasn't doing well in school. So while I was living with Mrs. Martinez, there was one point where I was doing so badly in my classes. I was changing schools. You know, every time I changed a home, I would change schools. Sometimes I would change schools, you know, 3 or 4 times within the matter of a year and a half. And so they sent a psychologist to give me some tests. They thought I might have had a learning disability. And I ended up scoring pretty low on this test. I did just well enough for them to believe I didn't have a learning disability. But I remember being angry about taking this test, because to me, it just seemed like more homework, more school, just more adults asking me to do things that I didn't want to do. You know, not only do I have to go to school, but now I have to take this test. And then after this, I'm going to have to, you know, go around and, you know, collect, you know, pull weeds or, you know, rake the leaves or something. I mean, it just felt like more burdens that I had to take on. And in hindsight, I think it's, you know, kind of absurd that, you know, here you have this kid that's moving homes and moving schools all the time, and he's falling behind in his academic progress. And the first thing that comes to mind is, oh, he has a learning disability, and they just want to medicalize him and, you know, whatever, give me medication. I don't know what the next steps would have been if I had qualified for a disability. And they didn't think to actually look at the root causes of, well, maybe he's not doing well because his environment is unstable and he's, you know, he doesn't know who his teacher is going to be in 3 months from now or which home he's going to live in. And so, yeah, I note the astonishing rates of psychiatric medication taken by foster kids in the book. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, adults are busy. The system works the way it works. It's overburdened. And people would rather medicalize and medicate than actually consider how these disorderly environments can affect children and their development.
How did you end up in Red Bluff, California, in the northern part of California?
Well, let's see. So I mentioned I was living with Mrs. Martinez. She was the final home I lived in. And at one point while I was with her, the state of California mandated that I see a child psychiatrist. And I think this was a sort of a typical checkup that every so often a kid in the system has to just go see a doctor or see a psychiatrist just to check in and see how they're doing. It, you know, maybe to diagnose them, maybe to medicate them, or just check in. And this psychiatrist actually took the time to look at my file and realized there was no hope of me ever being reunited with a birth parent. You know, there was no, you know, my mother was in another country. No one knew who my father was. There was no possibility of, you know, an aunt or a grandmother or someone else to take me in. And so this this doctor realized this and wrote up this report strongly suggesting that I basically be placed into the adoption system in California. And, you know, I think this is just sort of emblematic of how little attention is paid to each individual child's case, that, you know, it's just massive bureaucracy, and a child's file can just get lost and just sort of reshuffled into different homes. And no one actually takes the time to think, well, maybe we should put this, I should have been put up for adoption when I was three, and instead I was put up when I was seven, simply because no one actually took the time to realize, oh, this is, you know, there's no possibility of reuniting with my family. And so it just introduced a lot of needless instability. Eventually, a family in Northern California, the Henderson family, was a, you know, a man and a woman, they're a married couple, and they had a young daughter. It was their birth daughter. They adopted me and took me in. We settled in this kind of dusty blue-collar town in Northern California. You know, at the time, even to this day, it's located in Tehama County, one of the poorest counties in the state of California. And my adoptive family, you know, they were working class background. My adoptive father was a truck driver. My adoptive mother had various kinds of jobs. She was a, you know, certified nursing aide. She later became an assistant social worker, but she didn't attend college either. But they managed to get this kind of small home for my sister and me, and for the family. And it was a, you know, kind of a surreal feeling to be adopted. And when they had to carefully explain to me that this was the last kind of placement that I would ever have, that now you have a mom and a dad. They, you know, I remember I called my adoptive mom. I referred to her as Mrs. Henderson, and she was like, "Sweetie, just call us, you know, call me mom. You can call, you know, he's your dad. You know, if you're comfortable with that, we'd want you to call us that." And I was happy, more than happy to do so. By this point, you know, I was old enough and had been in enough schools that I knew, you know, kids had moms and dads, and, you know, I had Mrs. Martinez, or I had, you know, whatever other foster family. And, you know, I had all these foster siblings too. That was a difficult part of the system, was sometimes I'd enter a new home and I'd be a little nervous or anxious or scared or vigilant. And, you know, some of the kids were nice and they would, you know, kind of befriend me and I'd, you know, become friends with them. And they, you know, become accustomed, like, you know, even though this is a strange new environment, at least I have a friend here. But then my foster siblings would be taken to another home, or they'd go back with their parents, or they would go somewhere else. And so not only would I not know where I was going next, but I wouldn't know where my foster siblings were going to be from day to day or week to week. But then when I had my adoptive sister, met her, and yeah, realized, you know, once I fully accepted that I was never going to be taken from her and she was never going to be taken from me, and I would always know where she was and what she was up to. It was just a really heavy feeling to realize that.
Did it work?
Well, it worked for, you know, it was a temporary arrangement. So about a little over a year after the adoption, after I'd moved in and, you know, they changed my last name. I was, you know, Robert Henderson, adopted, you know, took their name, and had a mom and a dad. And it was a really nice, year or so. My adoptive father, I'd go with him on these long truck driving rides. We drove to Montana and back once. And, you know, I just remember this feeling of like, wow, this is my dad and I have a dad. And this is so cool to ride in his truck with him. And, just moments like that. But then, they got divorced. And this was really hard. Because I was, you know, I guess I was led to believe that this was going to be my family. And of course, I wasn't going to be put in a different home or something like that. But instead, for a temporary period, they separated into different homes. My sister and I would go to, you know, we did this sort of weekly arrangement where I'd stay with, you know, we'd stay with our mom for a week, then we'd stay with my adoptive dad, her birth dad, for a week. And then one day, my adoptive mother had to explain to me that, you know, just, you know, my sister was going, but I wasn't going to go this time to my adoptive father's house. And, you know, she explained that he was angry with her for divorcing him. It was, you know, her decision to separate from him. And so he decided to stop speaking with me as a way to retaliate and, you know, get back at her. And yeah, this was it was confusing for a lot of reasons. I mean, I didn't really think of my adoptive father as really, you know, capable of that. I mean, just overnight, no more communication with him. And so after never knowing my biological father and then living in all those foster homes and then, you know, being adopted and then, you know, losing contact with my adoptive father, learning that he no longer wanted to speak with me, it was just devastating. And so, you know, it was just me and my mom. We lived in this gloomy duplex next to this gas station in Red Bluff. And, you know, there were, you know, other kids in this neighborhood and around the school that I went to. And my mom was working full time and I was this latchkey kid. And for, for a time, I would just kind of go and hang out with my friends and smoke. I mean, the first time I drank beer is when the foster homes. I started drinking beer when I was 5. And then I started drinking tequila when I was 9, another hard liquor. And then, yeah, age 9 was kind of where I picked up all of these bad habits where I would drink, smoke weed, smoke cigarettes, take pills. It would, you know, we'd go to the store and take, you know, we'd get some cold medicine and see how many of these cold medicine pills we could take before we started to feel funny. Or eventually, you know, like friends, you know, their older cousins or someone's older brother would get us some generic Vicodin or some Percocets or something. And, you know, we just find ways to get high or get stoned or, you know, find a ways to alter ourselves. And my mom was just kind of too busy, too distracted, to really notice what was going on. And yeah, that was kind of the next phase in that, adoption sequence, was going from having this family to suddenly I'm with my mom and no longer have an adoptive father.
Did Shelley bring stability to your family unit?
She did. So at a certain point, you know, after the divorce, my mom started to visit a lot with this woman named Shelley, who was her partner. Eventually, my mom revealed to me that actually, you know, she was gay, she was in love with Shelley, and they were in this relationship. And I was 9, I was almost 10 years old by this point. And, you know, this was like 1990, this is 2000, I think. You know, this was before, you know, LGBT had been sort of more mainstream at that point. It was still not as commonly known, especially for, you know, little kids. And so it just kind of blew my mind, like, what? Like, you were married to a man and now you're with this woman. And I didn't have an issue with it. I was just, you know, kind of surprised that, oh, okay. But it was okay because by this point, you know, my mom had kind of told me like, before she revealed to me that they were in a relationship, she just said that, oh, Shelley's one of my friends and Shelley would hang out at our duplex a lot. And she was really nice to me. I mean, we would watch action movies together and she would make me dinner or, you know, make me chocolate milk or, you know, other things that I enjoyed. And she was, you know, kind of more honest and open and more, I don't know, eager to speak, I guess, in some ways. My mom, I think, was just dealing with divorce and her job and all these other issues that she was going through. And Shelley was kind of around. And once they, you know, had fully, you know, come out and, you know, entered their relationship and made it official, they got a house together and I moved in with them. And my sister would, you know, still do the sort of weekly thing with her dad and with us. And yeah, from about 9-ish to 13, they created this very stable home for my sister and me. And yeah, I mean, other than the fact that it was, you know, two gay women, it was essentially just a, you know, conventional two-parent family. We would have family dinners and they would monitor my, you know, progress in school, my homework, how I was doing. They allowed me to enroll in this, you know, martial arts at this boxing gym and, you know, encouraged me. And that was probably the most stable period of my upbringing, was when my mom and Shelley were together. And yeah, I still look back during that time very fondly. That okay, I never really had a father, but you know, it didn't bother me when my mom and Shelly were together because they were, you know, they were very present and very loving parents. And there were periods where they would attempt to like foist a father figure on me. You know, I think they had this concern that I was this young kid, this kind of, you know, I had a bit of an attitude and I, you know, enjoyed mischief and occasionally they'd get calls from schools because they'd get into fights or, you know, do something reckless. But they thought that maybe I needed a mentor, a male father figure, someone, you know, one of their male coworkers or, you know, someone's uncle or something like this. And I kind of had it at the boxing gym that I went to. But, you know, I didn't really feel like I at that point that I needed it. I think that the mom and Shelley were good enough as parents.
Rob Henderson, you write that as a kid, I was weighed down by instability and hopelessness. The military helped to unlock my potential because it provided a structured environment, a sharp contrast to the drama and disorder of my youth. I was surrounded by supportive people who wanted me to succeed. In this new environment, I gradually came to realize that my childhood was anomalous. And I didn't have to let it define the rest of my life. I'd been liberated from the mistakes of my past. I believed that the external comportment I had cultivated would allow me to control my internal demons and productively channel my restless energy. Was the military accidental for you?
It was half accidental. It was, you know, in the sense that it was somewhat impulsive, the decision. I enlisted right out of high school when I was 17, joined the Air Force, and you know that branch, it didn't hold special appeal to me necessarily. There were just two older male figures in my life that recommended it, and they both happened to have been Air Force veterans. So, you know, I'd mentioned the period of stability with my mom and Shelley, but then Shelley was shot. I tell that story in the book. She, you know, she survived and slowly managed to recover, but that introduced a lot of difficulties in the family, financial difficulties with the medical bills, and there were issues with, you know, our home was eventually foreclosed. My mom and Shelley split up. You know, I get into all this drama in the book, but, you know, by this point, you know, after my mom and Shelley split up, I was 16 or 17 years old. I moved in with my friend and his dad my senior year of high school. You know, I moved out of home essentially when I was 16. And, you know, at this point, I'd had, you know, I was mature enough and maybe introspective enough to realize that the path I was on was not good. I was barely passing my classes by this point. You know, all the kind of academic focus I had, you know, obtained and kind of exhibited in my middle school years during those years of stability, they kind of fell by the wayside when I, you know, hit puberty and, you know, all the family drama and all of these forces around me. And I graduated with a 2.2 GPA. And so, yeah, these two, you know, my history teacher was in the Air Force and he could tell that I had some glimmer of potential. He could tell that I was kind of a curious kid and an open-minded kid, maybe kind of a, you know, if circumstances had been different, more academically inclined. And he knew I wasn't on my way to college. He knew, you know, I was barely passing his, I think I had a D in history. And so he knew, but he could tell just from talking with me. And, you know, once he gave up this idea that he could sort of, you know, berate me into doing well in classes because I wasn't going to do that he just started talking to me like a person and just sort of saying, you know, what are you up to? Or, you know, what do you do with your free time? What do you know? And we would just talk and talk about movies or sports or whatever. And, you know, he was like, hey, check this out. He showed me this picture of himself in his Air Force uniform. So he was in the Air Force before he became a teacher. And I looked at the picture and I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool. And then my friend's dad, who I lived with my final year, him and his, you know, his brother. And, you know, he showed me this picture and he talked to me about the Air Force. And so I went to the recruiter and kind of on a whim decided to sign the paper, took the ASVAB, the military standardized exam, and, you know, didn't really give much thought to what it meant, what I was going to do, the job. So, you know, I had to go to MEPS, which is, I think it's military entrance processing, something like that. And that's where you choose your job, your occupation. And they listed out this kind of catalog of available jobs, and I just chose the one that sounded kind of cool. It was electronic warfare systems. I didn't know what that meant, but it had the word electronic and warfare, and that was good enough for me. I picked that job, and off I went. And I went to basic training in Lackland Air Force Base. This was like a month and a half after I graduated from high school. And this was a mistake. If I'd known just how hot Texas was in the summertime, I wouldn't have gone then. But I was also in a hurry to leave Red Bluff and get out of that environment. And it was, you know, in hindsight, it was probably the best decision I ever made, because it immediately got me out of the circumstance that I was in with my friends, with the jobs that I had, the coworkers, the people around me, the choices that we were making. And when I think about the direction of the lives of my high school friends and how I could have ended up in some of those positions. You know, I had five close friends in high school growing up. Two of them went to prison. I had one friend who was shot to death, other friends who were just kind of working menial jobs and not very happy with their lives. And, you know, that could have easily been me if I just stuck around and not made this spur of the moment, half-baked decision to sign and have my adoptive mom sign a, you know, what was basically a permission slip to allow me to go because I was underage. And I was by far the youngest guy in my basic training military unit. They're like, ah, you're only 17. Like, man, you were in a hurry to get out of there, weren't you? And I said, yes, I was.
How'd you get to Yale?
Well, so that's, you know, 8 years later. So I was enlisted for 8 years. I did 2 4-year enlistments, 17 to 25 years old. About a year out from my enlistment, I started to really consider what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I joined the military not because I was excited about it or because that's what I always wanted. It was more so I was on the wrong path, and the military would at least get me off the wrong path, but I still didn't quite know what the right path was yet. In my teenage years, by the time I reached my early 20s and, you know, matured a little bit more and became a bit more reflective and thoughtful, I realized that I'd always read a lot of books, even in high school. I wouldn't do the homework. I would, you know, basically find ways to just barely pass the classes, but I would still read the textbooks. I would practice the math exercises. I was just naturally interested in ideas and in learning and in, you know, abstractions and those kinds of things, you know. And so as my enlistment was winding down, and, you know, there were some setbacks and some hiccups and some difficulties along the way, but once I fully accepted that I should, you know, I should go to college, I should use the, you know, the military offers this incredible tuition benefit, the GI Bill. So I Googled around, eventually found my way to they build themselves as an academic boot camp, the Warrior Scholar Project, where they basically invite military veterans who are interested in going to college and just kind of brush up their academic skills, you know, how to write an essay and how to, you know, basically be a successful student. They also explain how the college application process works. I mean, I had no, I didn't even take the SAT in high school. I wouldn't have even known how to take the SAT. But then they kind of explained how to put a college application together, what the Common App was, you know, how to get letters of recommendation, all these kinds of things. And it was only a 2-week kind of thing. And it took place at Yale, of all places. It was started by a Yale ROTC student and a veteran of the Australian military, actually. And these two, you know, they were undergrads, and they started this project, this initiative. And so they invited me, and I think there were, I don't know, 15 or 18 other students, other vets. And it was a really incredible experience for me and helpful. And, you know, I remember being apprehensive that I would get into any colleges. I applied only to colleges that I, you know, had a real possibility that I wouldn't get into any of them. I enjoyed that experience at Yale so much, that the Warrior Scholar Project, that I thought, oh, well, maybe they'll take me as a student. We'll see. Got the interview, and I had to kind of explain why my college my high school transcript was not reflective of my academic potential. And, you know, I had to basically, you know, reveal just how chaotic my life had been and how, you know, I, you know, urged them to take a risk on me, and that I did take the SAT finally, and I got a really good score. So that, I think that saved my application, that my grades were horrible. My, you know, just, it was very, let's see, it was an atypical application for Yale. And they took me in, and I was very surprised by that. So I started classes in the fall of 2015.
Rob Henderson, you talk about your experience at Yale being unfamiliar with the top 1% culture, being told you were privileged. You talk about luxury beliefs, and you write that, quote, "the poor reap what the luxury belief class sows."
Well, I had known when I arrived at Yale that, you know, it's a famous university, so I knew that there were going to be students from more sort of affluent, moneyed backgrounds than the kinds of, you know, poverty and squalor that I had come from. But I wasn't fully prepared for the kinds of differences in social capital, in cultural capital, in outlook, in opinions and personal experiences. And I mean, one simple kind of disparity that I was shocked to discover was just how many of my fellow classmates were raised by two parents. I mean, especially, usually it was two of their birth parents. Whereas in almost every single one of them on campus that I interacted with, and then later I dug into the research and found that at Ivy League schools in general, the vast majority of students are raised by both of their parents. Whereas where I grew up in Red Bluff, I mentioned these five close friends I had, none of us were raised by both of our birth parents. There's a lot of single mothers, people being taken in by grandmothers or aunts, or, you know, my friend was raised by a single father. And that mirrors the statistics overall. But then I would interact with some of these students, and they would champion strange beliefs, to me, that were strange, at least, that, you know, I spoke with one student who said that marriage was outdated and, you know, we should evolve beyond it, that marriage was this kind of oppressive, outmoded structure. And then I asked her, you know, how she was raised. And she said that she was raised by her mom and dad, and that she, you know, that was her life. You know, that's how she was raised. And I asked her, well, how do you plan to, you know, what's your family arrangement? How do you envision that later in your life? And she said that she planned to, you know, find someone, get married, settle down, have kids, and kind of do the thing that she was familiar with and that what her parents did for her. And so this was strange to me. It was this strange kind of duplicity where she herself had obviously benefited from this kind of age-old structure. And the statistics bear this out, that, you know, having two married parents, that's the best environment on average statistically for kids. So she benefited from this structure, you know, not a coincidence that she and all of her friends and peers had that arrangement, and they ended up going to places like Yale. And she planned to carry this benefit forward for her own children, but her official public position was that people shouldn't do this and they should get beyond it. And over, I encountered beliefs from people who were, you know, relatively affluent, educated, either successful or clearly on their way to becoming successful. And they would espouse strange beliefs that, you know, maybe they felt that it was making them look interesting or sophisticated. I would later term these luxury beliefs, ideas and opinions that confer status on the upper class while inflicting costs on the lower classes. And these beliefs will win a lot of accolades and plaudits from their peers. But then behind the scenes, you know, as these beliefs get implemented into policy, or as these beliefs get implemented into the culture at large, this can have downstream detrimental consequences. I mean, even as a sort of a simple example of the ways that, like a recent example of this would be the Defund the Police movement. There was a massive survey from YouGov, representative sample of Americans, collected these data in 2020. And when they broke down the responses by income category, the highest income Americans were by far the most supportive of defunding the police, and the lowest income Americans were the least supportive of defunding the police. And yet, defund the police became a very popular movement in 2020 and 2021. And as a result, a lot of police departments across the country actually did reduce funding. And this also cultivated kind of an attitude of suspicion toward law enforcement. And subsequently, homicides increased, violent crime rates skyrocketed. And it's funny because you know, when poor people, marginalized people, when they were murdered or victimized, they got folded into these aggregate statistics of, you know, you'd open up, you know, some newspaper and it would say, oh, year over year, crime increased by this amount or homicides increased this amount between 2021 and 2022. But then whenever a member of, you know, what I call the luxury belief class, you know, as someone with a college degree who has a nice white collar job, when they get killed, they actually get like profile pieces in the media. There were two high profile cases, one journalist who was killed in Philadelphia, another in New York. There was a tech executive killed in San Francisco. And, you know, as a result of street crime or something similar. And they received these like profile pieces. They were identified by name and, you know, spoke about how much these people meant and so on. And I thought, okay, so my impression of this was that if, you know, a bunch of peasants get killed, they, you know, these are just a statistic. But when, you know, one of the aristocrats gets killed, a member of the luxury belief class, they get this glowing kind of obituary, this, you know, this very glowing newspaper article about them. So even when those luxury beliefs do end up inflicting costs on the upper classes, they're still treated differently and they're still conferred status.
Rob Henderson, we have about 2 minutes left. I want to get your quick response to this quote from your book. A question I wrestled with in the early stages of writing was, who is this book for? Whenever I thought about comfortable upper and upper middle class people reading it, quite frankly, it made my stomach turn.
Well, that was something I wrestled with all throughout the book, was who is it for? Who's the audience? I mean, this is something that, you know, a lot of authors, they think about. And ultimately, this book is for, you know, people who go to college, people who are concerned with issues around family policy, education, childcare, issues around class and social mobility in America. And those are the kinds of people who read and buy books. But the other thing was, you know, I wrote this book to be accessible. It's not full of jargon. It's not, you know, I have a PhD, but I didn't write it in this kind of highfalutin, you know, Byzantine academic language. It's written to be essentially, you know, if someone, I thought about someone like me at age maybe 12 or 13, some, you know, curious, open-minded 13-year-old kid who's maybe going through difficulty in their own lives. If somehow they managed to pick up this book, you know, that maybe the story would grab them and they could come away with something from the book as well. And so, yeah, it's I wrote it to be readable, and not a lot of academics or people with advanced degrees do that. And so the book is, I think there's something in it for everyone, whether you're a highly educated adult interested in how, you know, the other half lives, it, or if you're interested in social mobility and policies around the topics around education and childcare, or if you're just a kid who wants to read a story of someone who managed, you know, despite all the setbacks and all of the obstacles, to, you know, find a way up and, you know, share my observations of what that experience is like, that, you know, there's something for everyone.
Is that your picture on the cover? On the bike?
Yeah, that's me. Yes, that's me on the bicycle there. Yeah, that was the bike I received for my birthday. And I tell that story, I think, in the second or third chapter of the book. That was the first birthday gift I'd ever received. I never celebrated, or my birthdays were never celebrated in the foster homes. So that was a special moment for me to get a birthday gift.
And you report that 1960, 95% of families were two-parent households. We'll close with this quote from the book. Childhood trauma isn't bad because it leads to lower graduation rates or lower incomes. It isn't bad because it leads to higher rates of addiction or crime. It's bad because of the firsthand phenomenological experiences of the kids going through it. In other words, it's bad because it's bad. Frankly, even if stable and secure homes for children had no effect on future educational attainment, occupational success, crime rates, addiction, and so on, they are still worth promoting. A safe and loving childhood is a good in itself. The book is called Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class. The author, Rob Henderson. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Q&A programs are available on our website or as a podcast on our C-SPAN Now app.